Blog Talk Radio.
The game is 90 minutes. The show is 90 minutes. Coincidence? I think not. That music can only mean one thing. It is time again for the Two Guys Soccer Show. And it's a little bit of a different show because one of the guys, Stead, has decided this week would be a good week to take vacation. But where there's a will, there's a way, and we just happen to have a will. British Will. How you doing, Will?
You know, I'm doing all right. I've only had a part of the tree fall down today, so everything's going just great.
See? So we want to welcome Will Reba in, who will be filling in for Stead this week so that we can keep it the Two Guys Soccer Show, even if it is two not normally the same guys, but, you know, we'll work on that. As always, we are sponsored by the fine folks at Flanagan's Harp and Biddle, 4844 Cordell Avenue, Bethesda, Maryland, Maryland's premier venue for sports and live entertainment, and the place to be come 3 p.m. on Thursday when the U.S. women play Sweden in their final group stage game of the Women's World Cup. And, of course, Will, you have your own sponsor. We'd like to thank Will's Dirt Homemade Garage Beer for bringing you on today.
Excuse me, I think it's the Knobbly Knees beer. It makes your knees all wobbly.
Knees beer. Okay. I heard you have a new flavor that's just come out. Science experiment.
Yeah, it's gonna taste probably terrible, but you never know. It might taste nice.
You know, in a couple of years, we could be talking to the next microbrew. You could be the next Blue Dogs. You could be the next Sam Adams. Who knows?
I mean, it's possible. It's unlikely. It's almost as unlikely as England taking a trophy home this year. But, the English women's team might take one home. But I'm expecting them to come third, as per usual.
Place. The men's team did take home third place in the Nations League. So does that count as silverware, or is that just like the butter knife?
I mean, I always... It's just, I think, a bit cruel to make the two teams that lost in the semifinals like punch it out for the last, like right before the as the warm up event for the final. I kind of find that a bit cruel, but I completely expect the English women's national team to come third. So
two third place finishes and two international competitions this summer for England. Actually, that might be the best summer England has had in international soccer since 1960.
Well, we like to talk about 1960, don't we? And I was talking to a German friend of mine once, and I said, how do you feel about 1960? And they just looked at me completely blankly. I don't understand. I said, we beat you in the World Cup final, and they were like, oh, yeah. You did, didn't you?
Yep.
Must have been nice to have been to more than one, wasn't it? Yeah.
It could be worse, you know. Although I am getting a feeling watching the women play for what it must be like to be a Brazil fan when you don't pay attention to the group stage at all because you just know you're going through.
I mean, that's kind of the case for the American women's team, isn't it? Aren't they on, what, now 16 goal difference?
Yeah, plus 16. Yesterday was a bit of a lackluster showing. They only scored three. But actually, to be honest, that wasn't the best game for the women. Jill Ellis changed out 7 of the 11 starters. She kept the goalkeeper and Julie Ertz among the four regular players who started. But she managed to get in every player on the 23-woman roster, save the backup goalkeeper, has now played in the tournament. They scored three goals in the first half off of three set pieces. Carly Lloyd missed a late penalty that could have made it 4-0. But it was a hot game. They looked like a team that hadn't really played a lot together, probably because they hadn't. And I also got to give credit, you know, Chile's goalkeeper is one of the best in the world, and she definitely showed it. She had some amazing saves yesterday. Had I been in Vegas before the match, I probably would have taken Chile and the under. Chile was going off at plus 850, so a $100 bet would have won $8,500. And the U.S. was getting four goals, and the over-under was 5.
I mean, you know, it's just sort of what happens when you're just that good. It's sort of a foregone conclusion that you're going to clobber everyone in the group stage. It would be a really interesting group if you had the United States, the Netherlands, Norway and France together. I mean, Germany and France together. That would be a really interesting group stage for the Women's World Cup.
Fortunately,
not so much men's World Cup, but would be a really interesting.
Well, let's think about that. I mean, we've come close. The U.S., the Netherlands, Germany, and France in a Men's World Cup, that would still be an interesting group. I figured the men would finish last. You know, there was a group similar to that, not the same, but similar to it, in the 2015 World Cup, when you had Italy, England, Uruguay, and who else was in that group? And Costa Rica.
Italy. Yeah, and was this the 2014 World Cup?
No. I'm sorry. Yeah, 2014 World Cup. Yeah, it was. Wasn't it England, Italy, and Costa Rica and Uruguay?
Costa Rica and Uruguay went through, didn't they?
Uruguay went through. Yeah, it was the only time that three former World Cup winners had all ended up in the same group.
Wow, that's a. I mean, you know, you're going back a bit, but well, not that much, but it's always going to be interesting, isn't it? But I think that definitely the Women's World Cup that's going on right now is the most interesting thing that's going on, because, you know, you've got the Women's World Cup, you've got the Gold Cup, you got the Copa America, which has got, which I was looking into it, and it's a bit odd. It's got Qatar, Japan, and Japan in it. So I was thinking, well, are you just making up the numbers with them? I'm not certain what's going on about that.
You are, because there's only 10 teams in CONMEBOL, so in order to get 3-4 team groups, they always invite two extra teams. And in the past, it had been the U.S. has gone down there a couple of times. Mexico's gone down there. I think Jamaica went down last time. But the U.S. and the CONCACAF teams weren't allowed to go down because for the CONCACAF Gold Cup, which is going on at the same time, they have to field an A team. And, you know, just great scheduling. You schedule the two tournaments at the exact same time. In the past, the Gold Cup had been a little bit later, but the problem had been that the last time the U.S. went down, which was about, I want to say 8 years ago, so no, probably 12 years ago, in 2007, Bob Bradley took a B team with him. And because he wanted to focus on the Gold Cup, and the organizer didn't really like that. So they hadn't invited us back to the Gold Cup proper since. And so this time it was a scheduling conflict, and we don't have the man strength to cover one international tournament, let alone two. But, you know, a couple of summers ago in 17, when they – No, in 17 they did the Confederations Cup, and Mexico sent a team over to Confederations Cup, and then a B plus team to the Gold Cup. Ended up losing to Jamaica in the semifinals. The U.S. won that one.
Yeah.
And there's still talk that, well, I know that they're going to do another Gold Cup next year because they're actually going to switch to every 4 years on the even instead of every 4 years on the odd. which I don't know how that's going to play with CONMEBOL World Cup qualifying, which takes 3 years because each one of those teams has to play 18 games.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. International football is getting more and more cramped, isn't it? And
you know, and then with
it's sort of
the
Nations
League
sort of goes back to
now you got the Nations League over in Europe. Now you have the CONCACAF Nations League. We're going to try and do the same thing. All the international tournaments, it goes year round.
Yeah, I mean it's becoming more and more cramped. And I was watching the third place game for the England men's team in the Nations League, and I was listening to some of the commentary, and I'm sure a lot of people picked up on this, but it was Martin Tyler who said about Trent Alexander-Arnold, 20-year-old. I don't know if he's got the caliber to be playing in the national team because he's only 20. And I was thinking, you know, this goes back to the age-old argument. Why is there such a massive onus put on a national team level football in the men's game? Because at this point, none of the national teams, if they played against a club team, I don't think if they played against the top club team in the world, the top national team in the world would beat them. I think the top club team would absolutely trounce them. I don't know if that's a.
I think national team level is the great equalizer. And even though it's once every 2 years, once every 4 years for the World Cup and stuff like that, I think you really see the best players shine through in a lot of ways because the teams are set up differently. You're not playing with the best players. You don't get the opportunity to cherry pick. So when you get Ronaldo winning international tournaments with a team like Portugal, when you get Greece able to win a European championship, you know, you realize that the whole in those cases is greater than the sum of the parts. And so I do think that you see sort of the cream rise to the top in the national game. You know, I will talk about all the great performances that Zinedine Zidane had, but I think the one that sticks out to me the most is him carrying France to the 2006 World Cup final. Or, you know, the great, much later, but Pelé with Brazil. I mean, a completely different game now as then, but, you know, when you look at even the Spanish team of the late aughts, early 2000s, and just how they were able to come together and function when you had to blend two rival teams who day in, day out, week in, week out, really like each other, but for the good of the country had to come together. There is a certain cachet about national team football, putting on the national team shirt, getting to that level where you are recognized as one of the best 23 players in your country.
I mean, you know, that's a good point, but the game is moving on. You see this because, you know, we're talking about going back to the early 2000s where you had Zinedine Zidane, and then you're going back into the 1960s and 1970s, and yes, back in you know, the early days of properly professional sports, the national team was an incredibly important and incredibly prestigious thing to be a part of. And, you know, these players were working towards every day just to be able to go to that stage. But now I don't know if players really have the same emphasis on that, because, you know, they're playing for their national team is just another thing that gives them the opportunity to get. This is the argument of the club team. If you play for the national team so often, you have that many more opportunities to get injured, and you have that much opportunity to not play for your club team. Don't get me wrong, I really, really enjoy all the international tournaments, and I, you know, go wholeheartedly for England and all of that. But I don't know, the I don't know if the players have the same emphasis towards the national team as they did in the past. Now it's a sort of a question in my mind, because
I've certainly seen an example of what you're talking about. Timothy Chandler, who used to play for the U.S. men's national team, has a German-based player, had basically said, please don't call me up for certain games. And we've seen players take international retirements and a hiatus. You know, Lionel Messi did, Cristiano Ronaldo for a while did. I don't think it's the same thing. But then when it comes to these tournaments, you certainly see that they all want the opportunity to play. There still is something about pulling on the colors of your country and going out and representing your nation with your country behind. You know, from a fan's perspective, I think it still matters. I remember talking to a gentleman. Remember the gentleman in the Nobby Styles shirt at last year during the World Cup for the England match?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I don't know if you
remember.
He was saying at the end, he said, you know, I'm an Ipswich. We're never going to win anything. This is all I've got. And
I mean, so, you know, there is that, but I'm not saying do away with national football, but I think it's time to sort of take your head out of the sand and sort of look around a bit and say, you know, the national game with all of the tournaments that are cluttering up the schedule are sort of, you know, some of them are less prestigious and less important. So you can throw out a 17-year-old to play in the, I'd say it would be completely fine for England to throw out their U23s to play for the, Nations League. I'd say that would be a great experience for them, because they'd be playing against, you know, the best players from countries such as, like, countries in Europe and, you know, the friendlies that they normally play. And they get some great experience, because you see all the time, you know, people saying, oh, they don't have any experience in the senior level. This would be, I think, with all these cluttering of the tournaments, it would be a great opportunity for the younger players to get some proper experience before they go to the Euros. And then when they are just absolutely terrible at the Euros, or they shine at the Euros because they had the experience from before, if they're terrible at the Euros, it can't just be put down, oh, they had no experience, because they did. And I think that's sort of an important thing to keep thinking about, because, you know, you can't, with all the games, you can't have the same players playing every game, because otherwise you're going to have every player playing over 100 games a season. And that's just a recipe for, you know, even with improved medicine and physiotherapy, that's just a recipe for endless injuries, and you're going to lose some of the best players to, you know, terrible injuries, and that's just not what anyone
wants
to
see. I look at, like, Lionel Messi. I don't know that he has had a full summer off in, like, 6-8 years. Because just the sheer number of games. I'm with you on limiting the international calendar. I do believe, like, some of the friendlies and some of the, they should be an opportunity to be used for what they are, which is an opportunity to expand the player pool to see who works, who doesn't work. You know, I don't think that a Harry Kane needs to play every game. You know what you're getting from Harry Kane, just like for the U.S. men. You know what you're getting from Christian Pulisic. You know what you're getting from Zach Steffen. They don't need to play every game. That's a time to use those for guys like Tim Weah or the Trent Alexander-Arnolds of the world, who have not had a lot of experience at that level playing in the internet. And international football is different than club football, if only because a lot of times you end up playing in places that you normally wouldn't play, in front of crowds that you normally wouldn't see, and on fields and surfaces that you don't normally get to deal with. And sometimes it's like, hey, not everything is playing in front of 60,000.
Not every day you can
play
at Old Trafford, where they've got the best groundsman in the Premier League.
yeah, you know, every once in a while you're going to end up playing in Guatemala. You know,
exactly.
And you got to get used to doing that. So I'm with you on contracting it, but I still think there is something important about the international game. I think that we're seeing it, you know, with the Copa America. I'm watching Japan and Chile. It's about to be a final, and Chile, the two-time defending champions. It seems so weird to say that because it seems like so long ago that they actually won something. But they are the two-time defending South American champions. They just took part Japan for nothing, which with I don't even think they would be among the favorites for this tournament right now. That's a very old team. That is, you talk about having played a lot of games together. That's Chile right now. They've played a lot of games together.
Yeah.
But
I mean, I've got friends who've sort of discussed Chile winning the Copa America for the last two times, and let's just say they have not been overly happy with the way that Chile has won or the fact that Chile has won. Let's leave it at that. Some of my Argentinian friends have been quite explicit about how they dislike the Chilean team, and especially one Gonzalo Yara.
Yeah,
but that was a Uruguayan
friend. The works. Yeah, they gummed up the works. They defended. You know, going back to what you were talking about the importance of the the international game, I think one of the big blemishes on Lionel Messi's career right now is the fact that he has not won an international trophy, whereas, you know, Cristiano Ronaldo, for better or worse, has. What you think of the fact that he went off early in the game in the Euros and how they played to get there, or how you rate the Nations League? The fact of the matter is, on his record, he's got his last two finals and he's won them both, whereas Lionel Messi has struggled. You know, they went down to Colombia, and I thought which was probably the biggest game of the group stages in this tournament. They went down to Colombia in their first game 2-0, and it looks like it's going to be another struggle for the Argentinian national team this summer. And can Messi win that elusive international tournament, which is probably the only thing that is not on his resume right now?
Well, I mean, I think that – I mean, I went to watch the – Venice. I was in Spain during the spring, and I saw the Argentina versus Venezuela friendly that Argentina ended up losing. And I don't think that you can really put that on. I don't think you can put this Argentinian team right now on Lionel Messi, because I can't remember if it was a. Someone who said, it was a manager, can't remember which manager said, give me Zinedine Zidane and 10 pieces of wood and I'll win you the Champions League. That's just not true, because you've got Lionel Messi, and watching that friendly, I know it was a friendly, you know, during an international break, but that Argentinian team, it just doesn't play together, and it just is a you can't really say it's on Messi when you don't have a team around. I mean, because Argentina, when they... Because they've been to the World Cup final. They went to the 2014 mm-hmm. World Cup final against Germany, and they lost in an extremely dull and ground-out final against probably the best defending national team that we've seen for a long time. And
yes.
Then they've been to the Copa America final. It was the 2000... I can't remember which Copa America, but it was the one that made Messi retire.
He lost two straight. He lost in 15 and 16.
Yeah, so he's been to those two finals straight, and, you know, It's difficult to say that, you know, you can't put it on him, because he is the talisman. He's the captain of Argentina. You know, he's the best player on earth, and he's probably the best player of all time. And he's just so good that everyone puts it on him to win it all. But then you look at Portugal in the World Cup, and like not in the World Cup, in the Euros. And they weren't relying on Ronaldo. They played as a team, and they won it as a team. And, you know, Ronaldo went off injured. And I know everyone was saying, oh, he was such a great player-manager to encourage the team. It wasn't that. It was the team was good. Like, they knew how to play their game, and they played their game, and they won it.
They actually probably did better without him because they did not have him, so they had to do what they did. Remember, I don't think that that was by the best Portugal team that I had seen recently. They were very defensive. They set up to just not allow France to do anything. And
they didn't win a game in 90 minutes. They didn't win a game full stop until penalties.
And Didier Deschamps got very conservative with his selection and his tactics. He set up to play defensively, which is not what that French team did. And I think they learned a very valuable lesson. I don't think that France won that final I don't think Portugal won that final as much as I think that France lost it.
I mean,
you know, when
France obviously learned a valuable lesson. They went on to win the World Cup.
Because
you saw
how they played against Croatia.
They went out and they attacked.
And because they knew that that was what their identity is, that's what they do, and if they're not doing that, then they can't sit back and defend. I look at a lot of teams who have a lot of attacking talent who refuse to unleash it. Jose Mourinho. When you've got thoroughbreds who want to run, you need to let them run because that's how they win games. Bringing it to the U.S. women's team, I think a large part of what happened to enable them to win the game against Thailand 13-0 was because Jill Ellis set that team up, her starting lineup, up to attack. Their defense is their press. Their defense is their attack. If they're not attacking, if they're not winning the ball, if they're not pressing, then that's how you end up put players in positions where they're going to get injured, where they're going to get confused, where they're going to lose momentum. That's how you create more problems than you solve by saying, oh, well, we're up enough now, we'll go back and we'll sit back and defend. That team is built to do that. You know, Thailand in that particular game played right into their hands. They weren't aggressive. They weren't physical. They didn't try and confront them. And not for nothing, if you watch the Thai keeper play, I'm sure she is a delightful young woman. But there were times where she was just like, nah, you know what? She was made. In football, we call them business decisions. When you're not going to get up there and put your head in there because you don't want to get hurt. She made a couple of business decisions at the back end of that game where it was like, I'm not getting involved in this. There's nothing for me.
You saw
that the Chilean team was a little bit more defensive. They were a little bit more organized, but they were also a little bit more aggressive defensively. And as a result, the USA women had a bit of a tougher time opening them up. Again, 13 goals in one game. They did not score a goal from play in the game against Chile. So we'll see.
Well,
I do
we'll
want to get your opinion
against Sweden, but I can't see them doing anything but winning. Let's just put
it
that way.
I think they want to win because of the 2006. At this point in time, there really is no incentive for them to go out and win the game. Actually, one might argue that they might be better off losing because they would get Canada and potentially Germany, and they get Canada in the round of 16 and potentially like Germany again in the semifinals, you would avoid playing France in the quarterfinals, which is what is going to happen right now. So before we totally change subjects, I want to get your thoughts on the English women's national team, who have kind of, they're like the third or fourth favorites, definitely behind the U.S. and France, but they've been quietly making noise. They've had a pretty solid tournament thus far. They made it to the semifinals 4 years ago, and they're kind of buoyed by the growth of the Women's Premier League. You know, Chelsea and Manchester City both having women's teams, Manchester United putting together one, but the Chelsea ladies have been on the European stage in the women's game for quite a while, and I think the U.S., the English women's team is starting to see the benefits of that.
Well, I mean, it's the idea that if you have a league in your country that can sort of grow the talent, it's going to improve. And I think that recently, well, I've seen this with Liverpool, Liverpool especially, they've started to, you know, integrate their men's and women's team a bit. No, well, not integrate, but, you know, every so often their men's social media account will say, hey, look at what the LFC ladies are doing. And, I mean, the LFC ladies are not the best team by any stretch. I think they came 11th in the Premier League this year, seventh in the Premier League this year, in the Women's Premier League this year. But, you know, I think that's a really important step because the Men's Premier League in England is the biggest league in the world. And I think that the growth of the Women's Premier League is just sort of, it's feeding off of that more and more. And, you know, I think this year, was it Arsenal that won it? The Arsenal ladies. And I know they've got the Dutch woman who won, the Dutch 22-year-old who won the women's Ballon d'Or this year. And I think that, you know, the growth of that league really has aided the subtle development of English talent because, you know, you see it all over the world. If you have nowhere to learn to play, then you're not going to be able to play. And that's sort of a little bit of a statement towards the MLS because, you know, as much as it's growing and, you know, I think the last 3 years at least they've added a team and now there are 12 teams in each conference. I don't know if it's set up to grow players. And I think that, you know, I think that building a league...
It's set up to grow players, but not American players.
Yeah.
It has aided in the growth of CONCACAF as a whole because all of a sudden you have players from Guatemala, Jamaica, Trinidad and Tobago who are coming over, getting professional contracts, getting good training facilities, getting better coaching than they would traditionally, and not having to go and then getting noticed picked up. I think that the problem that I've said with MLS is that top-tier talent peaks out, and there's been such a push among MLS teams and the ownership to keep top-end U.S. talent that needs to then, when it reaches a certain level in MLS, go over to Europe where they can get that, where they can grow even more here, and to the detriment of the overall growth of the U.S. men's national team. You know, we have a player like Christian Pulisic who just made the £50 million pound move to Chelsea, who I think could end up on his day becoming one of the best, if not the single best, outfield player for the U.S. men's national team. And he got his start, and he's played most of his career over in Europe because he knew that, you know, had he started over here, it would have stunted his development. And I think it's been a good move for him. So what you're seeing is more and more young U.S. players foregoing MLS and going directly to Europe.
Well, I mean, I saw that with, my friend, he played for a local club, and one of his teammates, Gideon Dalalem, at about the age, I can't remember how old he was, but he went over and he joined the Arsenal Academy and he started playing for them. So, you know, that's sort of one thing to see. You got really young teenagers who notice, like, this league isn't set up for me. And I think that sort of goes off the way that America develops their sporting talent by sending them off to university to learn to play there in, like, the university system. Because I go to the University of Maryland, which recently won the NCAA tournament for soccer. And, 2 years ago now, we were in that tournament, and we were projected to win it, and we dropped out. But we had a really incredible center back called Alex Cornali. He was 6'6", you know, and he could score just about anything. He was a center back, and he was incredible as a center back for the team. But he was named as the NCAA attacking player of the week for like 4 weeks in a row because he just kept scoring. But I don't think that as much fun as I had going to the Maryland soccer games, I don't think that that's a really sustainable way to grow talent for the American national team, because right now you've got young Americans going into the MLS at 22 years of age as they come out of university. And they miss out on so much potential for training. And, you know, there's a lot about the American football and how much do the people who go to college for American football actually learn at college. So there's a lot to be said about that as well. But, you know, it's just, well, it's not sort of a academy type thing where you're training to be something. You can be something after. I don't know.
I think that more and more MLS teams and the Philadelphia Union are a perfect case for this. They traded away all of their draft picks in the last MLS draft because they had said, and I feel correctly, that identifying talent in college is no longer the way to go because most clubs worldwide identify solid talent at a younger age, as young as 10, 11, 12 years old. And that 16 to 18 range for a soccer player is a critical period for development. More and more you're seeing younger and younger Americans. I would have to look up, but I would guess that only a small percentage of the 23-man roster for the U.S. men's national team actually played NCAA soccer. By that point in time now, what we're seeing is that most of the best talent has been identified and selected either to a MLS club academy or a international academy. And so guys that are playing in college are sort of either late developers or they're good college players and they may be serviceable pros, but they're not going to be fodder for the U.S. men's national team. The last player that I can think of that went from college to the national team was Jordan Morris, but he actually made the national team while he was still in college. He made it as a junior, the summer of his junior year. He ended up impressing Jurgen Klinsmann so much in a training camp that he selected him for the national team as the first amateur to play forever. But we've had this antiquated college system when it comes to soccer because haven't developed the European model for academies. And we don't need to do that in most other sports. I mean, you could argue that the AAU model in college basketball is sort of akin to that. There's nothing like that in American football, nor is there going to be, because you can't play, I don't care who you are, you can't play professional American football at 18 years old. Like, that's just not going to happen.
I mean, but a lot of science is saying soccer, you can't really play professional American football full stop without...
Yeah, well, that's a different...
That's a completely different kettle of fish, but, I mean, yeah, I see what you're saying.
And so
we have, you know, when you look at the likes of the U20 team that went over to the into the U20 World Cup and made it to the quarterfinals, third straight quarterfinal. I mean, not exactly what you were hoping, but still, to be able to put together a team that's consistently able to perform at that level when the bulk of your players age out every tournament, still pretty impressive. Most of those guys are either MLS club players or European players. So you had Paxton Pomykal, who plays for Real Salt Lake. I heard he's on Liverpool's radar. Tim Lea, who was knocking in goals for Celtic and has played for PSG. Josh Sargent, who's on the books at Werder Bremen. You know, you've got a lot of young under 20 talent in the U.S. going over and playing in Europe now because they recognize that the MLS can only get you so far, and they've seen what has happened to the likes of Giassi Zardes and Josie Altidore, Juan Agudelo, guys who came into MLS at 17, 18 years old and whose growth eventually stunted. You know, you can even look at Matt Miazga, who ostensibly is on Chelsea's books. I don't think he's ever played a game for him.
I remember a couple of years ago he was the next big thing going to Chelsea.
Yeah, and, you know, I think he's a better player for his experience over there, but probably won't make the team over there. At Chelsea, Cameron Carter-Vickers is another one who's on the books at Tottenham, but has played most of his career in the championship.
Yeah,
but those guys are recognizing young that's what they need to do.
Well, I mean, it's sort of, I was reading through the MLS website, and there was a guy who wrote a sort of piece on this, and I got to the Chicago Fire section of like a mid-season review of it. And one of the sentences really just stuck out to me, and it was talking about the center back pairing at Chicago Fire, and it said whether Bastian Schweinsteiger and Francisco Calvo could be a suitable center back pairing. And I'm just thinking, you've got Bastian Schweinsteiger, who is a midfielder, and even in his day wasn't a fast midfielder, so he's obviously, and he's well past his day now, and he's gone to Chicago Fire, and he's playing out of position at Chicago Fire to cover for centre-back. And I'm just thinking, where is the MLS talent that can come in and say, look, you go into midfield, I'll take the centre-back spot. And where is the coach that's brave enough to say, all right, we're going to try a 17-year-old at centre-back? Where's the coach that's like Jurgen Klopp and who'll say, all right, go have a run out, a 17-year-old. No one knows who you are, like Klopp did with Kai Janne-Herwert this season. Go have a run out and see if you can impress.
Well, I think the problem is, for any coach, you've got to be really, 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 really secure in your job to do something like that. I look at when they gave Marcus Rashford his first start. You know, Anthony Martial gets injured in warm-ups, and Louis van Gaal said, you know, who you got down there? Who you got down there who you think can play? And they sent him, okay, Marcus Rashford looks good. The only Angel Gomez got his first run out because it was right before the Europa League finals, and Louis van Gaal said, it was Mourinho, I think, who gave Gomez his run out because he said, I'm playing any of my starters in this game. I'm going to play all the kids. And he did. But those are guys who are secure enough in their position that they're willing to say, okay, I'll give the 17-year-old. You know what happens to Jurgen Klopp if he gives a 17-year-old a run out and they don't win that particular game? Nothing.
I mean, but at the same time, I'd hate to be a manager where if I lose one game because of one decision I made, that I get, I don't know, unless you're a manager that's really, really waiting for the sack, I don't know if losing one game because you made the idea to put a 17-year-old and test them out in a position, I don't know if that's a, I mean, I can't really think of any manager, any sitting manager who would get the sack for that. I think that's just them saying, look, you know, I'm trying to develop this and it's been done before. I don't know. Maybe that's my supporting style. Because even if I had Brendan Rodgers in the end of his days as Liverpool manager and, you know, the centre-back at the time, who was Martin Skrtel, had gotten injured and he had a 16-year-old on the bench and he'd put him out there to give him a try, I would have said, all right, that's a bold move. I'd have supported that more than him putting out a midfielder who, in a game, I don't know. That's just, I think,
well,
that's
the
sort of the managing
of
that you need to have.
So,
I want to pause right now. Probably like 8:20.
So call him. So he's down at concession stand. All right, I want to pause right now to thank once again Flanagan's Harp and Fiddle, Bethesda, 4844 Cordell Avenue in Bethesda, Maryland, Maryland's premier venue for sports and entertainment. They are our sponsor, as always. They're keeping us on the airways so that we can bring you not the best in soccer knowledge, but the soccer knowledge that we got. They'll be a great place to go down. You can go down and watch the Women's World Cup. You can watch the Gold Cup. You can't watch the Copa America, though, because that's only on ESPN+. Plus. You can watch the Gold Cup, and you can watch the Women's World Cup. So the USA men take the field tomorrow at 10 p.m. I got a guest coming up who can commiserate with me on that decision, and the USA Women at 3 p.m. on Thursday. So head on down to Flanagan's Harp and Fiddle, 4844 Cordell Avenue, Bethesda, Maryland. You can watch it on the 100-inch big screen. Will, you've watched a couple of games back there with me. It is a lot of fun to watch a game on that screen.
Oh, it's definitely an experience.
You feel like you're sitting in the middle of the game. So we are happy to have Mr. Leo Haggerty, the non-experts expert on soccer, joining us this evening. Leo,
how are you?
I'm doing fine. Welcome to the show. Stead's off this week. He decided that he was going to jet away to parts unknown, some undisclosed location. But I found a serviceable fill-in, so I got British Will on. Leo, how's it going, Leo?
Well, down in Dallas, well, really Fort Worth, we're at TCU doing an American football camp. So we're staying busy here, and had a very interesting weather pattern yesterday. Tried to land in Dallas, and a little bit of tornado action. So it was kind of crazy, but had a chance to watch a little soccer and everything, and the Gold Cup's getting interesting. So that was fine, and after the 13-0 fiasco with the United States women, which everybody said, well, they should have subbed and this, that, and the other thing. And Mike, I know you would like to make a commentary on that, because I said that you can only sub three people. Well, if you sub three people and somebody gets hurt, what happens?
You play with 10 men, or 10.
And if it's your goalie, it's not pretty, right?
I've seen that happen too, where you've had to put an outfield player in goal. I'm thinking back, Will, you might remember this years ago. It was Manchester United against Portsmouth, and they were out of subs. And Thomas.
I think he got Kuchka sent off.
Got
didn't
a
he?
Red card. Huh?
He got sent off, didn't
Thomas
he?
Yeah, and Real Ferdinand ended up playing the end of the game in goal.
Yeah, he made a save.
One save.
Wow.
But I also remember Harry Redknapp at the time saying, I wasn't worried about seeing Rio Ferdinand play goal. He did that as a kid, and he stunk then.
Yeah, I mean,
but
you know, you see that sometimes. I have to say that I thought that the women playing to the best of their ability for a full 90 minutes was admirable. I think that was a good idea, you know?
I think
but
that they
not,
used
as,
it
as
like
my father
what it
said,
was.
You're not playing under five, so... So, I mean,
this isn't an AYSO game. There is no mercy rule. I think that they should not have. There are a couple of things that I disagree with. One was I don't understand why they added 5 minutes of injury time at the end of the second half. At that point in time, I think the game was 10-11-0 going into injury time. They could have just said 1 minute and subbed it out. I think back to the finals of the 2012, Euro 2012, when it was Italy and Spain, and they get in the ear of the fourth official telling them to blow the game. And one of the great acts of sportsmanship I can remember Iker Casillas getting in the ear of the fourth referee telling them to blow the game. You know, respect for the team, respect for Italy, respect for the chance. End the game. It's over. It's 3-0. They're not going to win. So,
yeah.
And I didn't understand why they felt the need to celebrate every goal like it was the World Cup Championship. Like, you know, yes, after five, you've been there before. But I understand, like, they wanted to celebrate the players, and it was a team thing, and it was a team-building exercise. And in 4 ways to 1, this was a team-building exercise. It was an exhibition game for them. They went out, they tried different looks, they tried different player personnel. She bought on the players that she wanted to make sure got game time, and it was what it was. And that may prove valuable against Sweden when you need to have those players playing.
Yeah, I mean, I saw no problem with anything that the U.S. women did. I thought that, you know, you're playing in the World Cup finals. You better be ready to play the best team in the world. And you better be ready to give out your best. And the U.S. did, and they celebrated like they did. And I can't say I'd have done anything different had I been on the field that night.
Well,
Leo,
you know what,
if you think that was bad... There was a game recently, like this past weekend in Macau, 39 total goals scored.
Was there a goalie involved?
Yeah, he scored 2.
Oh, jeez. Hey, never a dull moment in soccer, right?
Yeah,
never.
But you know what, guys? You bring up a great point there. You know, it's not the job of the other team to not score. You know, Well, welcome to the world of professional soccer, professional sports, you know. You can't take the heat, you get out of the kitchen.
What was it Steve Spurrier used to say? If you don't like to see us score, stop us.
Exactly. You know, I can remember when I was coaching down in Newberry and we played the Citadel when they had Stump Mitchell. And they scored so much they ran out of ammunition for the cannon. You know, and it wasn't their job to do that. It was our job to stop them, and you know we didn't do a real good job of stopping them.
But that said, I do think that Thailand is going to go down as probably the anchors of this Women's World Cup. Yes, they scored 1 goal against Sweden. Not sure how that happened, but. To see them go down like that. And I think this brings up a good question. You know, how do you rate what France has done? They barely got by Nigeria, but I still think Nigeria is a better team than Thailand. If you put the two of them, I suspect that Nigeria would win that, and but for a moment of madness, it could have gotten awfully awkward for the French ladies in France had they drawn that game against Nigeria.
Well, Mike, I got to ask you the question is, how come they got a second penalty kick? That's the big controversy now, isn't it?
Well, we've seen that happen. VAR, which, well, VAR is being run a little bit differently than I remember it being, because they're doing all the reviews in the booth. I thought that it went down to the officials to make the call on the field. Now they're making the call in the booth, which I'm not a huge fan of. I liked it better when they flagged the official on the field and said, you need to have a look at this, and then the official made the decision as to whether or not they agreed with the call that they had made. But they said that upon further review that she jumped a little early. This is, I think, the second consecutive time that happened for the French where they've gotten another crack at a penalty. I seem to remember it also happening against Norway in the previous game. But they said that went early, and as a result, a second penalty needs to be taken.
Yeah, well, I mean, VAR's run differently across the board, isn't it? It's run differently, and you can't really... I'm not certain how it's being run at this World Cup. And, you know, I'm just watching the video now of the actual penalty. And I've always found it a bit suspect when they have people retake spot kicks, because that's just, you know, I don't know.
It's hard enough. Penalties aren't saved, they're missed.
I mean, penalties aren't saved 50%. It's supposed to be a 50-50. And
but it's not
watching
a 50-50.
This now, I don't think that she went early. And I've definitely seen keepers go before that. But, you know, I really dislike penalties. Because I think it puts the keeper at just a really crappy position. And it just makes them look silly most of the time. I think that the way that the MLS used to do penalties, where they had the player running from half field, that was more fun. And I think it was just...
That was a lot more fun. But I would not be against... I know that we, you know, Leo will complain about penalty kicks as long as there is a day to complain about them. Maybe
yes, I will.
Maybe the solution is the old NASL shootout where you get the ball at the halfway line and you have to run up and then shoot the ball, because then at least it gives the keeper a shot to stop it. I'm watching the. I just want to bring up. I'm watching the introductions of the Gold Cup match between Jamaica and Honduras, which, number one, I have a problem with this being on at 9:30 at night. But again, the USA men are going to kick off tomorrow at 10. I don't know why they don't need studs. But can Honduras play a game that should be a neutral site game in a tournament that's based in America in Kingston, Jamaica?
Yeah, I mean that's a neutral site, isn't it?
A real tournament anyway. I mean, you've actually got teams in the Gold Cup that can't compete anywhere else.
Yeah,
Martinique got a game yesterday. Their players aren't eligible to play anywhere else in FIFA.
Well, didn't Cuba get beat 7-0 by Mexico? I think it was.
Yeah, I believe that's right.
The U.S., like, Cuba is a weird team. They stay qualifying for tournaments like this and then getting hammered. I think four years ago, the U.S. got Cuba in the quarterfinal round, either the quarterfinals or the round of 16, the best USA team, and they beat Cuba 6-0. So I saw the first match that you sent me to, Leo, was a USA qualifier against Cuba at RFA, and as I recall, that night the USA won 5-0.
That's pretty much a blowout. Anything after 3, correct?
I would say losing a game 5-0 is akin to losing a baseball game about 15-2.
That's not 13 good.
13-0 is like, yeah, 13-0 is like when Camden beat Penn Tech 120-20.
Oh God, I saw a film of that. I think Milt Wagner had like 60.
No, it was Milt's kid. Wani had 100.
Right. Yeah, it was ridiculous.
So we'll watch. I mean, clearly, it's great because, and I do want to bring this up, this is a great summer for soccer. You've got the Women's World Cup going on, which is an interesting tournament. I mean, I think it's been a great tournament. I think we'll start to see a little bit more turnout for support for the women come the next game on Thursday. It was Father's Day. Not a lot of people going out and watching the game, but so far, everywhere I've gone, people have wanted to talk to me about it. I suspect that come Thursday, you'll start to see turnout, especially the quarterfinal match against France. If that comes around, you'll see a lot of support. The Gold Cup, the USA Men in action on Thursday, the Copa America. You've got kind of the best teams in the world playing in that tournament. So just all going on all at the same time. Now, the biggest beef I have is that the Copa America is only available on ESPN Plus, so you can only stream. And I was watching the Chile-Japan match today. That coverage is awful. It's one commentator. I'm not even sure if he's actually in stadium. It's that bad. And no halftime.
Wow.
And why are the USA men playing at 10 o'clock tomorrow? Leo, don't give me that stuff about we got to get the West Coast audience. Why are they playing at 10?
You answered your own question. They got to get the West Coast audience.
So in order to get the West Coast audience, you're going to totally eliminate the East Coast audience?
On a Tuesday night, yeah, it's not real smart. That game should have been no later than 9 o'clock Eastern Daylight Time, because 9 o'clock gets it done by 11-ish, 10:45, 11-ish.
Why is this game being played at 10? Why do they have one game in the group stage that starts before 9 o'clock? They have an 8 p.m. on Saturday, and then their other game is at 9. Why are they starting so late? Why are we starting these games so late? Because
Mike, I have a question. Where are they playing the game tomorrow? What stadium?
Allianz Field in St. Paul, Minnesota. It's a new stadium, home of the Minnesota FC.
Well, that kind of answers our question then. So it's really 9 o'clock body time for those guys. So it's still not a smart move. It's not a smart move.
Well, I mean,
so you just answered the question. They're playing at 9 o'clock body time, which you will never, ever play a regular game that starts at 9 o'clock at local time.
Unless you're NCAA basketball. That's about it.
Yeah,
but
no,
again, that's it in a tournament. No, this is when you're the only game being played there that night, There's no reason to start it that late. I mean, we've seen NCAA
right
games.
Now, Jamaica are playing at 9:30 at night. Will, what game in Europe starts that late?
Well, I can't really think of any game in Europe that would start that late because that would just invite violence. I mean, if you started a game that late in England, you invite people to go out drinking at 11:30 at night. And that's just not what anyone wants to do.
Yeah, the hooligans would get a little upset.
I can't see any sort of benefit of starting these games this late. I mean, I'm seeing tomorrow you've got Mexico-Canada at 10:30. I mean, no, not tomorrow. On the 19th, you've got Mexico-Canada at 10:30.
Like, these guys are playing these games. They're playing in Jamaica. This is 9:30.
This sounds like it sounds like you're playing intramural college like games, you know, 30-minute games. I mean, these are the times that those games start. This is not like you can get the West Coast involved if you start the game at, I don't know, 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Every kickoff that I'm familiar with in Europe, the latest of them go about like 8 p.m. local time, right?
Yeah.
You know, Mike, I can remember.
Champions League match, but I've never seen anything where you guys coming out to play a game and they're warming up to start a game at 10 o'clock or 9:30.
Right.
These guys are literally going to start playing this game right now at 9:30 local time.
And it just goes to show you that television is going to just completely rule the roost when it comes to this. And
but that goes back to that goes back to what I'm saying about the Copa America. All right, you have one of the best tournaments in the world going on right now. Leo Messi, Neymar's not playing because he's hurt, but Leo Messi, James Rodriguez, Colombia, Argentina, Brazil, Chile, some of the best teams, biggest names. I'm not saying that you have to interrupt your primetime lineup for it, but ESPNU was showing coverage of the NBA draft combine. And ESPN News had repeats of earlier programs. ESPN2 is showing a 30 for 30. You can't put these games on. You can't put them on regular network television. You have to put them on a streaming service.
The only thing it makes is dollars and cents. And that's where the network's looking for programming. They're looking to plug it in at a time that fits them, not a time that fits the massive amount of fans that are going to deal with it.
I think, and increasingly, the USA matches have been starting later and later and later. And I think that they're just missing the mark on this. If you tell, I don't think that it has to do with the West Coast market, because why would you isolate the Eastern and Central market? Because this game is starting at tomorrow at 9 o'clock. In Texas, at 10 o'clock in the I-95 card, the only thing that you're getting is the West Coast market.
I think it's got to do, I'm pretty certain that the U.S. game starting this late has got to do with the fact that the U.S. men's national team didn't qualify for the World Cup last time. I think it's
you're
got
starting
to be
at
that
10
because
o'clock in a tournament that's being played in the U.S. That's sponsored bought and paid for by the U.S. The Gold Cup is not a real tournament. If this was the World Cup, I'd say okay. But the two biggest draws that you have in this tournament are Mexico and the United States. The only thing that's going to move viewership in any direction is Mexico and the United States. Like, I'm not even sure that Canada maybe. But Mexico and the United States. And you've got those games starting at 10 o'clock at night.
Yeah, they don't want to lose
those
7 people.
This is not a tournament that's
organized
around actually caring about competition.
Mike, they don't want to lose those 7 people that are watching Trinidad Tobago.
You lost the people who are losing watching it in Trinidad and Tobago. They're on a completely different time zone.
Yep. People don't realize that. It's crazy when you look at it's almost as bad as the way the NFL treated the Buccaneers with 7 away games in a row. It's like, come on, you got to be kidding me. And
yeah, well, you guys volunteered to go over and play in England. That's your fault.
Oh, that's our home game. Yeah, it's just crazy. It's just
how do you
crazy.
Guys have 7 away games in a row?
Play three, 7 weeks. They go without a home game. They play 3 on the road, go to England, get the bye week, 2 more on the road. Their last game at Raymond James is the end of September. They don't get back again until November. The end of November.
Other than a new stadium being built. All right. So I've seen it happen where, like, for instance, with the Anfield redevelopment project, Liverpool will probably go out on the road for a significant portion of time.
Right.
I mean,
when was the last time you saw a Premier League team play 7 on the road on the spin?
7 games away on the trot? Sometimes it felt like Liverpool was playing 7 games. I mean, I don't think there's ever really been that many away games. I know that Liverpool has played 5 away games in a row within the last 2 seasons.
But
generally, it's more of a mix-up.
Yeah, but those are not – I guess the difference is those – you can play, like, 5 away games if the Premier League schedule and the cup competition and Europe line up against you. Or you're rebuilding your stadium.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, what was it, West Ham, when they moved into the new stadium, they were saying, it feels as though every game is an away game.
Yeah, well, every game was an away game because they should never have left the bowling ground.
Yeah. I mean, you went
just
from
like
forever blowing bubbles at the field to forever throwing balloons at the field so the players could still see it.
Can't even throw balloons at the field. You got that track around there.
Yeah, I mean, the balloons would land on the track, so they stopped blowing bubbles. They started throwing balloons.
So, and, like, you speak of that, I think we talked about West Ham moving into the Olympic Stadium. I think Everton is going to lose something when they leave Goodison.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I could never imagine Liverpool leaving Anfield, and I'm sure that's the way that, like, most native fans to their feel about their home ground, and I just can't imagine what it would be like.
Not over here. We go through stadiums once every 20 years. I've actually seen the Atlanta Falcons go through 3 in my lifetime.
I mean,
so,
but that's the
that's the American model.
Yeah, I mean, you moved MK Dons, and then an entirely new football club springs up AFC Wimbledon, and now they're ahead of MK Dons.
Well, that was just a dumb move on on Wimbledon's part in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, they were bought by an American owner. He thought, oh yeah, it's going to be exactly the same over there as it is over here. Turned out it wasn't. And AFC Wimbledon restarted and was like, okay, we're ahead of you now. After 10 years or so, they were ahead of MK Dons.
That's
so
crazy.
Does that put where are they? So does that put them in League 1 or are they in League 2?
I believe that both MK Dons and AFC Wimbledon are now in League 2. League 1? I think they're both in League 1. I think MK Dons got promoted last year.
All right, so for those of you who are uninitiated, that would be the equivalent of being in AAA or AA baseball.
Yeah.
Because the only way you can make sense of that, of the English league system, is to look at minor league baseball. So imagine.
It's a really funny system, isn't it? Because you got the Premier League, and then you got the Championship, and then you got League One, then you got League Two, and then you've got the. Then you've got the non-league system, and the non-league system has an entirely different, really fun sort of supporting tree.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I've talked to one of the guys who was down there, and I know Leo's got to leave real soon, but I'll tell this story. He was a local supporter of a very small local club over there, and insurance salesman, who worked for the club as their videographer on weekends. I kind of love that about some of the smaller teams in England, that you can, as a fan, just root for your team and actually work to support them in ways like, I have a skill, I'll put this to work for you. Frightening moment for Philadelphia Union fans. I'm watching Jamaica and Honduras right now, and Andre Blake went down with a knock to his thigh, but it looks like he's going to be all right. I thought it was a non-contact injury for a second, which in any sport, those are always very concerning. But so I digress for a second. Leo.
Yes, sir.
I know you got to run. You're in Dallas and you're coaching a football camp.
Yes.
Good luck for you.
It was a pleasure being on with you. And again, I'm the non-soccer fan.
You always give us a unique perspective of the expert who knows sport, but maybe doesn't watch as much soccer as we do. So it keeps us in line because we can figure out what to talk about.
Well, I try to help out. Well, gentlemen, you have a great evening, and I will talk to you when needed again.
You do.
All right.
Take care, guys.
Thanks a lot, Leo. So, Will. Again, I tell you, this has been this hour and a half just goes by so fast. So, as we're wrapping up the show, what's going through your mind? What do you, as we look to the next week of football?
As we look to the next week, realistically, it's really only the Women's World Cup for me. I know that the Copa America is on, and I know that's sort of it's got the massive teams. You've got Brazil, you've got Uruguay, you've got Chile, you've got Argentina. And I know that the Gold Cup is on, and I find myself finding it difficult to look at the Gold Cup when you've got teams playing and the times that they're playing, that you just think, there's so much room for development in this, and I think that you could combine the Copa America and the Gold Cup and make it into a bigger tournament and make it more than it is
Thank
and
you.
Push the players harder. So really, Thank it's you. Got to be only the Women's World Cup going through my mind.
I remember the Copa America Centenario, 3 years ago. So 2016 version, when it was played in the United States, and it was the 10 South American teams plus 6 invited North American teams, and just how amazing that tournament was. And the thought of combining these two tournaments into a true North American Cup, and maybe you set it at 16 teams, and then allow for qualifications so that you can get a Caribbean team. You know, Jamaica was in it because they were invited. I think Trinidad and Tobago were in it because they were invited. But allowing for the fact that you could have a Haiti or somebody get in there, but turning it into a true 16-team tournament as it was a couple of years ago, I think would be just amazing. And I remember saying that year when it was the Euros and the Copa America, by my math, you had 28 of the 32 teams that were going to be playing in the World Cup in action in one summer, and that makes for a great summer. So I think they should combine this tournament. I think that having this, and the problem with the, my problems with the Gold Cup are multiple. It is such a jury-rigged. They don't even do pots. The U.S. and Costa Rica and Mexico are automatically the top seeds. And it's set up specifically so that the U.S. can play Mexico in the finals.
Yeah.
I think they just need to do away with that, combine the two. And I think it would be good for development overall.
I mean, I think it would definitely help the U.S. grow if they can play some teams that, because in all seriousness, you know, there's no offense to Curacao or teams like that, but that's not a team, that's not a country with enough people to make it and an infrastructure for set up for soccer to make it a competitive game for the United States. I mean, the United States needs competitive games to improve.
Technically, if you want to get into it, it isn't a country. It's a Dutch protectorate.
I mean, Curacao, the United States.
That's Curacao, Martinique, they can't qualify for the World Cup. They can't play World Cup qualifiers because they're French and Dutch overseas territories. Their players, their best players, are eligible for other national teams.
Exactly.
Because I think that when you look at, there have been a number of great Dutch players who have come from St. Martin's and Curacao. I think Edgar Davids, either Edgar Davids or Ruud Gullit was from Curacao. I know Rafa Varane, who currently plays for the French national team, is from Martinique.
Yeah.
So their best players are going to end up playing for either France or the Netherlands. So they can't be competition for the U.S. They would do better. And I think the U.S. learned so much more playing against in that Gold Cup when they had Jurgen Klinsmann had a little bit more to him and decided to actually challenge Argentina in that semifinal match. I think it would have been good for him. Remember, the U.S. finished fourth in that Copa America Centenario, lost to Colombia in the third place game, which we've already talked about. But had they challenged Argentina a little bit better, I think they had they been more willing, I think they could have learned a lot about themselves.
Yeah, I mean, it goes back to this this need. I mean, England has this too, the need to be the best. And the U.S. just has to realize that it's not going to be the best in a soccer game if they don't put in the work to get there. It's kind of like telling it, because the U.S. training structure and the U.S. league and the U.S. players, they're basically toddlers and they're playing against grown men in major tournaments because they're playing against Dutch overseas territories in their serious competition. You know?
We're going to play against Guyana tomorrow. If the U.S. does not win this game, multiple goals to nothing, then it speaks about the quality of the U.S. I said before the women played Thailand and Chile last week, I said the only thing that we can learn about first two matches of the Women's World Cup is going to be bad. The only thing that we can learn on Thursday about the U.S. is going to be bad. If they don't go out, and I'm not saying that they have to keep a clean sheet. I don't know that it needs to be, you know, I don't know what 5-0 versus 6-1 looks like other than the zero on the scoreline. You still won by five clear goals, right? You're still the dominant team. you know, if you have a moment of madness and a goal goes in, it happens. I don't know that they, but I know that they need to win by multiple goals, and I would say a plus three goal differential in that goal in that game tomorrow is a minimum. Just like for the women, I thought a plus three goal differential in both those games was a minimum. You had to win by at least three clear goals. The only thing that we can learn about the U.S. tomorrow on Thursday is going to be bad.
Yeah, I mean, the U.S. men's national team, I think it has to take pointers from the U.S. women's national team, because broadly speaking, they're far superior in the way they run, and you know, I think that the way the team works together, I think that they have to take some notes on the U.S. women's national team, because you can't really compare the two teams. But the U.S. women's soccer organization is superior to the U.S. men's soccer organization. And
I mean, one of the things is that, though, that the I will say this, the U.S. women play a lot more games together than the U.S. men do. And they, as a result, are better able to develop a team. You see how they read each other, but there are also a little bit about skill, right? I don't know if I have seen a striker put on as clinical a finishing display as Alex Morgan had against Thailand. For my money, she had five shots on target, and all five of them went in the net.
Yeah, I mean, but I think they just need to, I think the men's team really has to realize they're starting, they have a great opportunity to start from nothing, because if you realize that, then you can't really go backwards, because you can only, from nothing, you can only go forwards, because they didn't qualify for anything recently, and the entire interest in them from the greater U.S. as a whole has gone back to nothing again. Because I think it's 2010. No, it was might have been 2014. But they were talked about in the same breath as the English national team. And now the English national team is being talked about in the same breath as the German national team. So, you know, England obviously was like, all right, we started from nothing. We can move back up. And the US was like, oh, look at where we've gotten to. Let's settle. It's kind of like what you're saying.
But look at where I think the England national team learned. It was a long, slow lesson to learn from the failure of Steve McClaren and the 2008 European Championships when they failed to qualify. And what was it, the loss to Croatia when Scott Carson started, having never started the game and led in the rain, and the images of Steve McClaren on the sidelines at Wembley with the umbrella. To go from where you guys went to really where you are right now, you know, semifinals of the
one major tournament in a sort of ramshackle one.
Mm-hmm. I would think that they would enter the next Euros amongst the finals. Yes, I agree with you wholeheartedly. The U.S. has the opportunity to move on from here. So, as we exit this show, it has been absolutely a blast. Will, I really want to sincerely thank you for filling in today. It's a lot different doing 90 minutes than it is doing a half hour, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, you've really got to think a bit more.
Yeah, but you did a phenomenal job, so thanks to you, Will. Thanks to producer Paul, the silent man. Paul's like the Wizard of Oz, the man behind the curtains who makes everything run on time. Thank you to Leo Haggerty for coming on and giving his opinion from Dallas at a football camp. I know that wasn't the most convenient thing for him. Thanks to our sponsors, Flanagan's Harp and Fiddle, 4844 Cordell Avenue in Bethesda, Maryland. Once again, thank you to all. I'm Mike. This has been Two Guys Soccer Show. Y'all have a good one.